So I don't like bragging, but something amazing just happened. I went outside and I got the mail, and then I came inside and I looked at the mail, and there were two envelopes from HBO, one with my name on it and one with my wife's name on it. I ripped open mine, and it's a residuals check for $309.73 for appearing as a reporter for 6 seconds in the first ever episode of Winning Time, the show based off of my book, Showtime. And I was feeling amazing, better than amazing. I was the king, on top of the world, the man. Oh, my wife was in Winning Time episode 1-2. She even had a speaking line.
My check was $351.75, sucker.
God damn it. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Ava Wallace, the Washington Post's Washington Wizards and professional tennis beat writer. This is episode number 326. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Ava, thank you for doing this. I want to say, Ava, I want to start this by saying, and I'm being serious about this, you have a great name. Ava Wallace is a name that rolls with it. It rolls off the tongue. It sounds cool. It sounds professional. You could be a journalist. Hi, I'm Ava Wallace from the Washington Post. You could be a flight attendant. Hey, I'm Ava Wallace. What would you like to drink? You could be a lawyer. You could be the president. It is just a cool sounding name, period. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. It's also very, one thing I like about my name, it's very like neat. It's all triangles and like sharp letters. It's like, what is it? It's 10 even. Ava, middle name, Ava Rose. It's a good one.
Yeah. And I can also tell you that for years, Perlman, and this is not something people talk about. With Perlman, you get stuck in the Earl area. So when you call people and you say, hi, my name is Jeff Perlman, they'll be like, Pellman. And you're like, no, Perlman. And they'll be like a million times. So I feel like there is something nice about calling someone for a story. Ava Wallace, no one has ever tripped over the name Ava Wallace.
Unless they're not American, in which case everyone trips over it because the AVA sound does not exist in anywhere but the US. So the way my name sounds everywhere else should be spelled EVA. So everyone calls me Ava, or everyone gets it wrong outside of the US, which is very funny.
So we have a lot to talk about, and there are a lot of things I want to ask you about, but there is a topic on the show that I'm always into 100%, which is people who cover teams that suck. And
what do you mean?
What are you speaking of here? You are the Washington Wizards beat writer for the Washington Post. And I'm not saying the Wizards were the worst team in the NBA last year, because they were not. They finished 35-47. In the offseason, they got rid of their star player, Bradley Beal. Their second best player, Porzingis, also gone. You had to write a lot of stories about a really fucking bad basketball team over and over and over and over again. What is it like to cover a bad team?
It's very, very funny that you started with that, because I listened to your interview with Sally Jenkins in preparation for this because I was very nervous. And she said something that really...
You were nervous for this podcast.
Yeah, there's like, you know, a lot of very like writerly writers come on this podcast, and I'm not, you know, whatever.
And Ava Wallace.
And me, exactly. So I was listening to her talk about the kind of nature of covering not just a bad team, because there's a difference between a bad team and like a hopeless team. And I agree with you that the Wizards were not the worst team in the NBA last year, but like something my editor and I would talk about frequently is it was really hard to think of a team that had less hope than the Wizards last year. Like even the Orlando Magic, you got something really fun going on. You got a couple of good young guys. Like the Wizards really had just absolutely nothing except for the hope that you're going to trade Bradley Beal, which isn't hope at all. That's like really depressing. And Sally was talking about just kind of the nature of covering a bad team, how it kind of, it's like a vortex, like it sucks everybody in with it. It's actually kind of something the folks who cover the Wizards talk about a little bit. Like on media day, a new player will come in, will be like, wow, they were great. They've got so much verve, you know, they had, and will almost immediately say like, it'll get them. Just wait, give it a season. They'll become kind of Wizardsified. And I think that happens to writers too. And that's what Sally was talking about, how it's kind of a depressing thing to cover a team like that. And that's what it's like to cover not a bad team, but a hopeless team. A team that maybe you could argue isn't run very well from the top, a team, you could argue, where, you know, the players have also kind of sussed out that it's not very good organization or anything like that. You have to really work hard, something I found. And I don't mean to sound like we're still watching sports at the end of the day, like whatever. But you have to work hard to find things that keep you afloat and find stories and people that like make you like your job still. That I feel like that got really deep really fast. But I do feel like a lot of writers have to do that, whether that's going into, I know some writers who go into the nerdiest part of that and like just kind of feed their obsession that way and say, well, at least I can write about these analytics and stats or whatever. I am not an X's and O's sports person really across any sport, but especially across something like any of the big four. I'm never going to be that interested in the technicality of it unless there's a really cool technical story. So for me, I had to work really hard to find kind of personalities and storylines and like funny, stupid things to write about that I don't think people cared to read about that much, but they kind of kept me going a little bit.
It is an interesting thing I've never thought about, which is on the one hand, no one really wants to read about the shitty Wizards losing their seventh straight. Like nobody gives a shit. On the other hand, you find out that like Anthony Gill has pet hamsters. Does anyone really give a shit about that either? Like, what's an example of a story you worked on where you're like, well, it's kind of interesting, but blah, blah, blah. Okay.
I did a story on the equipment manager this year. The Wizards had a very famous equipment manager. I think Zach Lowe did a big story on him from Summer League last year, who would like have a big karaoke party every year and da, 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 da. This is the guy after him who was just so beloved in the Wizards locker room. And I didn't really know anything about what, how much an equipment manager has to do or like, and he came up through baseball, which I know is kind of like the best training you can get as an equipment manager. So I don't know if people were that interested in it, but I was like, I'm just going to write about this guy who is really nice and always around and probably knows everyone's secrets. And it turned out to be a pretty cool feature. And I got to ride on the team plane, which was the first time I ever did that. And that will ruin you. Don't ever do it.
Wait, I'm going to tell you something. This is off topic. When I was covering baseball at Sports Illustrated, the Oakland A's were the wildest team in baseball, right? And I flew on their plane and I was super excited to fly on the A's plane because I thought, oh, this is going to be crazy. And I get on the plane and it was 6 hours of them listening to music on their headphones and watching movies. And it was the most boring experience of my life. Your Wizards flying experience, the opposite?
Yes, from an NBA beat writer perspective. And I was like, these seats are so wide. And there was like the like endless churn of good food was just like shocking to me. I'm like, we're taking a 2 hour flight and you start off with chips and guacamole and then you get a hot meal. Then you get a hot meal in the air. And then they're like, before you go, would you like a ginger shot? I'm like, what do you like? No. I mean, I did. I took like eight, but yeah, it was fun.
The story you're referring to, behind the scenes with the Wizards and all that dirty laundry, February 3rd, 2023, the subhead was the equipment managers are part of the team that makes basketball team go. It was 11:11 a.m. on Saturday in November, just under 3 hours before the Washington Wizards boarded one of their 65 chartered flights this season. On the whiteboard that hangs in the small equipment room tucked in the far corner of Entertainment and Sports Arena was a packing inventory for back-to-back games at Memphis and Charlotte, detailing the color of compression undergarments the team needed for each game and a to-do list that included refill socks and buy more candy. Under a section titled Player Needs, another list, KD, Giannis, LeBron, sneakers to pack. It would all have to wait for Royce Reed, the Wizards equipment manager, and Tom O'Connor and Jorge Robles, who round out the department. It is rare an hour goes by without interruption. When you pitch this story to the equipment guys, are they like, oh, amazing, someone wants to write about us? Or are they somewhat skeptical? Oh, why do you want to write about us?
These guys were like, we're both. So Royce, who is the head equipment manager for the team, has been doing this since he was a teenager and he would work in minor leagues in baseball. So he was kind of just like, this is really boring. And I was like, no, this is, I don't know, like, I had no idea that there is a new pair of socks, compression shorts, sleeves, every single thing a player puts on their body, every single game. And if they don't use it, they toss the brand new socks in the trash can, all of the plastic goes. It's like such a machine. And I was like, that's so interesting to me. They take care of every little detail that these players need. Like the thing that they got interrupted for that day was someone came up to them and was like, KP Porzingis is wondering if we could replace the plastic bottles in the entire building with glass bottles, which like, yeah, good for the environment. Oh, he was worried about microplastics in his system. And like, that's the shit this guy has to deal with. And that was, I don't know. I didn't know that. And I had never thought about that. So I thought, well, maybe someone else has never thought about that and would like to read that story.
The team's fourth string center, Isaiah Todd, poked his head into the room with a shoe in each hand, exclaiming his rep had sent the wrong pair. Then O'Connor spotted Lacey Bruins, Monumental Sports Facilities Director, and pulled her aside. Crispus Porzingis had expressed a concern earlier. He wanted to know whether the team could switch back to making glass water bottles available at practice. He doesn't want too many microplastics in his system, O'Connor said as Reed folded laundry. In professional sports, happy players are a competitive advantage. Rarely do fancy the people who make that a possibility. So are you rolling along with these guys, writing down absolutely everything? Are you like how they fold the shirt, how they fold the socks, how they do this? Are you just like obsessive compulsive about it?
I'm basically always looking for my lead, because when I was a younger writer, I would get caught a lot without having a lead that I liked. So anytime I'm with someone in person and actually get a chance to see what they're doing, which isn't that often in the NBA, like access isn't bad in terms of like, you can sit down and talk with a guy, the Wizards are good about that, but it's not often you get to kind of follow along with them. So I was like taking pictures because I always want to remember like what color things were, or like, it was very funny to me that on the whiteboard that has everyone's size and stuff, it was like XL, 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 XL. And then Monte Morris, who like is an NBA point guard, a big dude, was just like medium. And I was just like, that's fun. I don't know. It's like little details like that are funny. So I was writing down absolutely everything I could, just so I could, in case I wanted to use it later as a detail, because this I knew would be a story that was made by the details.
When the Wizards add Jordan Poole this year, which was, you know, kind of a big deal for the Wizards. And he comes in, they do the press conference with him and Kuzma, and they're both super excited and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And you've been around for a while since the bubble. You've been covering the Wizards and you've seen kind of the malaise that it is to be Wizards. Can you personally, as a writer, can you buy into the, oh, this might actually be good? Like, do you have a moment where you're like, oh, maybe this will work and this will be great? Or are you just like, have you been doing this long enough with this team that you're like, eh, whatever.
Yes, I can, but it wasn't. So I wasn't at that press conference. I was covering Wimbledon then. But I did have that moment this summer when they replaced the front office. And I started seeing how quickly they made moves. And like, they were kind of like, we don't really care what we get in return for Bradley Beal. Get him out of here. Same with a lot of other players. And they just started making transactions. That's like a very specific. It had been put to me a lot in the last season that the Wizards front office did not have the power to transact. So that's why that's in my head. That's when I was like, oh, this like is actually pretty exciting. And this is an opportunity here. And as someone, I'm from right outside of DC. I started thinking like, if these guys could really get people to start caring about this team, that would be pretty cool. And they might be able to do it. And it seems like they're kind of on the right path. So I definitely had that moment, but the Wizards are in a place where I don't think that can come from a player. I think it has to come from the organization, which is totally unsexy from like a reader's point of view, but I think where the change had to happen.
Right. Well, so your entire time with the Wizards, Bradley Beal has been the star, and he's been a star player. You've covered. When he goes off to Phoenix, is it the nature of covering the NBA these days where you send Bradley Beal a text, hey, it was nice covering you or something, or is it just goodbye, next player?
No, that's exactly what I did. I sent him a text, and it was also like, I started backing up Candace Buckner on the Wizards in 2017 during the playoffs, and Brad has always been, he's always been good to the media. I think any Wizards reporter would say that, but so he just turned 30. I turned 30 in November. Like we have a lot in common. We kind of spoke the same language, even though he's a bajillionaire and has three kids.
Are you not a bajillionaire?
I do have three kids, but I'm not a bajillionaire. That's where we differ on that. Right. Just kidding. I do not have any children. But we related on a human level very well. So I did send him a text and was like, good luck. What was tough about last year is that you could tell that Brad was also off. And I think anybody watching him could, you know, I'm not like saying anything crazy here, but like it was kind of fascinating and sad to watch a player who had decided he was going to take the money, and which I do not at all, but like obviously I would, you know, I don't blame him for anything like that. Come to terms with what his decision meant in terms of his career. And that was like, I don't want to say harrowing, that's a bit dramatic, but you could see the effects. You could see the direct correlation of signing that contract and then being like, this is what I've done. Even if it was just for a year. So that was really interesting. And I wish I had been able to write about that more deeply. I never found the time during the season, but that was an interesting thing to watch Brad through. So yes, I did send him a text and say, good luck, wish you the best.
What does it mean when a superstar is good to the media?
that he says yes when you really need him. I don't think there's a lot of NBA reporters who are going, I don't think there's a lot of reporters generally who are going up to the superstar of their team for every little thing, but you pick your spots. And when you need the superstar of the team, you kind of got to get the superstar of the team because either there's an issue you need their opinion on, or if you're working on a big feature. And Brad was pretty good about saying yes to those requests. John Wall was always fantastic to talk to. And he would do that too. He would make you wait 2 or 3 hours. And Brad very rarely did that. So that's what I mean. It's just, he made himself available when it was important.
It's funny. I have a friend who, she's seen Madonna in concert recently. And she said Madonna made fans wait like 3 hours for her to come on.
Yeah, I heard about that.
That's some serious bullshit. Lauryn Hill does that too. It's like bullshit. These people are actually your most loyal fans. And you're literally making him wait 3 hours. I can't even like get past that. And like I've covered players too, like a John Wall, who make you wait. And it's almost like they seem to do that on purpose to a degree. Does it not drive you fucking crazy?
I am the least patient person. It drives me insane. I think part of it is kind of myth making and part of like their lore of like, oh, I'm this guy who you've got to work. And part of it is like they're doing shit like getting massage and they take their time and you are not, they're making it very clear that you are not on their priority list. And sometimes you kind of have to bite the bullet and suck that up, but it's definitely worth it. Most of it, like with John, it was always worth it.
Wait, why? Why was so good about John Wall?
He had no filter and he was very authentic. And even if you ask the question, you start off saying it kind of like polished or whatever. If you just asked it again, he would be like, well, and then just go and just tell you. And he didn't keep things close to the chest. But if he did, it was like for a reason. He was doing like a wink, wink, being coy thing. And then you could write about that. You just always had something to write about with him. Right. He was very good. And just like, he was just like talking to a dude.
It's interesting, guys like John Wall, because I think maybe as an older writer also, you see, like I covered guys, nice guys. I'm not saying John Wall's not a nice guy, who would kind of make you wait or knew their status in the moment. And then in a blink, it's gone. And John Wall, 5 years from now, and John Wall was a great NBA player for whatever, 6 year period. John Wall would not be recognized in shopping malls in most places in America. And it comes and goes so quickly. And I feel like most athletes don't have that perspective. Or am I wrong?
I was going to say, but John Wall would disagree with that. I was just going to interject and say, like, I don't think John Wall understands that. But he was such a character and like he wasn't laying into that. He wasn't like, all of his bravado was so natural that it just made you want to be like, oh my God, do you hear yourself? Which is, of course, great to write about. And he'd been through so much. So there was so much backstory and just the way he responded to it was like, it's like, you know, when you talk to someone who's been through a lot of therapy and you're like, I hear that you have worked this out and you have a nice, neat thing to say to me. I think John Wall has been through some therapy. And so it's great to have raw emotion to work with, because then you kind of, as a writer, you get to, without being an armchair psychologist, you get to craft that into something. Like it's like clay. You get to mold it and say, here's how I'm seeing how John Wall is working through this. And here's what I think this means. And like, he hasn't maybe necessarily connected these pieces, but it's plain to see right there. And that's such a great thing when a reader can be like, oh my God, this happened. And then he said that, and he doesn't realize how that sounds, but you don't even have to do that much work as a writer. You can just put it in front of you and be like, look at this, guys. Like, what about this guy, huh?
This is one of my favorite topics in the world. Okay. You're talking with John Wall. It's whatever, 5 years ago. You're talking to John Wall and he's like, blah, 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 blah. He's just giving you great stuff. And then he's like, and that's why I fucked that bitch, because she fucking had it coming or something, blah, 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 right? Do you owe it to John Wall? Is there anything in that writer-athlete relationship that prevents you from using, that's why I fucked that bitch, she had it coming, because he's giving you all this time over the years? Or are you like, holy shit, I can't believe you just said this?
I didn't have that relationship with John. I didn't cover him that much. Brad, sometimes he would say something and I would be like, did you hear what you just said? And because it was more of a conversation. Uh-huh. And that worked in my, but I would tell him, I would be like, Brad, you understand how that sounds if I print that, right? Or I would say to him, like, I hear what you're saying. Imagine how that looks when I write it down in the newspaper and you're not making that face or something. And if he would just like look at me and shrug, I'd be like, okay. If he'd be like, yeah, you're right. I would like figure out a way to communicate what was going on without throwing him under the bus, because there's such a fragile trust. And like, when you earn a player's trust like that, one, I'm always kind of like, on a human level, I always feel icky doing that. And I think that's kind of what makes me a bad NBA writer, and sometimes a bad like sports writer in general. But like, I have a really hard time 90% of the time justifying burning someone like that, when I can find a way to communicate the same exact thing without fucking up someone's life, potentially.
Oh, it's the most interesting part of this job, because we're not very redeeming. And I feel like when journalists come to grips with the reality that a lot of what we do is kind of taking advantage of people to a certain degree, like we're taking their thoughts, we're putting it in print and on whatever you want to call it, on the screen, whatever. And then we're putting it out there and we're getting paid to do it. And a lot of times these guys have no idea what's coming. And it's just part of our job.
I do tend to justify it right now in my career with being like, well, maybe if I was writing a book, or maybe if I was covering something, I don't know, that in my mind is like highfalutin and much more important. I'm like, but really, I'm just writing a feature about the Wizards. Am I really going to do that for this feature about the Wizards? And I tell myself, like, later in my career, I can do that. You can burn the guy, you can get the quote and deal with the fallout. I tell myself that, and I wonder if I'll actually stick to that if I do ever get to that point in my career. But yeah, I definitely feel a type of way about it. I'm like, maybe I should be a little bit more ruthless, a little bit more cutthroat. But like I said, I don't know. I always kind of check in with myself and try to find that justification. And most of the time I can't.
All right, I'm going to throw one at you. We're interviewing Wizards backup point guard Jordan Goodwin. I pulled that one out for you. You're talking to Jordan Goodwin one day and he's like, yeah, man. And that's why my family and I stormed the Capitol. We just thought it was the right thing to do. So blah, blah,
okay,
blah.
Okay, that's different.
Like, is
that's
there,
but different.
But I mean, is there how do you know when to use stuff and then when not to use it? How do you know when to say to his player, you sure you want that out there? I'm happy to write it. You sure? Versus, this is great material, I'm using this. Like, is there a line? Like, how do you know?
Of course there's a line. I mean, that was, I'm sorry, that was a bad example. I don't mean to insult you.
Yeah,
but like,
cool.
That one, yeah, I'm going to use. But there's a line in terms of like, if I give the player the chance and they double down, great. And I made sure that they, you know what's going on. Sure. Do I know that this is a veteran who knows how the media works and not some guy I'm talking to at Summer League or something like that? You know, a 19-year-old. There's a million different ways to kind of feel out if what you're doing is right. Would it be a major news event? Like, you know, that our democracy is hanging on if I did that. Like, yeah, there are a million different ways. And I don't think it's that difficult to tell. For me, at least.
My example was not great. That was fair to call. Yeah.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is KSU Perlman, and I'm here with Anna Norris, my co-host on the hit KSDT radio show,
We're So Crazy.
So, with the Screen Actors on strike, I landed us this pretty sweet gig doing an ad for my dad's podcast.
What the fuck's a podcast?
This thing old people watch.
Well, what's the ad for?
RoyalRetros.com. It's a throwback sports merchandise company that makes pretty sweet t-shirts, hats, and jerseys of old sports leagues.
Do we get paid?
In t-shirts. But he also says, if we do a good job, we might advance to hats and jerseys.
And then what?
And then you wear a hat.
Hard pass. I'm going back to my side hustle slinging rocks on the streets of La Jolla.
Well, you've covered some interesting stuff. You covered Georgetown. Patrick Ewing was a coach. And I'm older than you. I've been in this business longer. Patrick Ewing was a pain in the ass to cover as a player. He was a dick. Nobody liked covering him. He wouldn't talk to the media. He was mean to the media. He was an asshole to cover. What was he like to cover as a coach of the Georgetown Hoyas?
Oh, man. He was so interesting. One, Georgetown was still holding on. So Big John Thompson, died after I stopped covering the Hoyas. So he still had a lot of influence on that program when I was covering it. And that meant that they were not at all forthcoming with media. And Patrick knew. I mean, that was like ingrained in Patrick's blood. No one had to tell him how to not talk to the media. So it was really fascinating watching this guy who had so much to prove. Like, he had to prove he could run a program. He had to prove he could do it in college. He had to prove he wasn't just this like alumni, you know, whatever hire. And I think he really, really, really wanted to do well. So it was fascinating to kind of watch him tell you as little as possible while also clearly wanting to do a good job and be taken seriously. I think he never said anything that groundbreaking to me, but he was very open when we would talk about like his family and his experiences and his background in that way. I honestly think it had a lot to do with the fact that I'm a young Black woman, and he felt like I don't know, some sort of comfort, or maybe underestimated me or whatever, something like that. Like, I never got a weird feeling like in that way, in terms of like him underestimating me. But I don't know, he just, like, once he kind of niggled him a little bit, he would open up, or at least I got him to open up, but just not about the program, like just right. about himself and about what it was like. And especially since, like, I told him, and I was like, Patrick, I'm too young to have, like, lived through your NBA thing. Like, tell me about it. Like, what was that like? I just went back and read this. I just watched this documentary. Like, oh my God, you actually did that? And he would, like, chuckle. And I think he enjoyed, like, telling me, like, yeah, that's what it was like. And, like, shit actually happened and all that stuff.
Was it obvious he wasn't a very good coach?
Yes. College coaching, one thing is being a good coach. That's fine. Like, a lot of people are good basketball minds. You have to do so much more. Like, the recruiting is tough. The relating to college kids is tough. Patrick was used to dealing with adult men who were competing for money and would do what he said and understood who he was. And I don't think he was ready for all of the, like, you have to care about grades when you're the coach of the Georgetown Hoyas. You have to care about, like, crafting people into men. And I'm not saying Patrick didn't care about that stuff. I'm saying that, like, someone coming in from Patrick's experience would have had to have a very robust support system around him within Georgetown as a program. And I don't know that Patrick had. So he was asked to do a lot of things that were not in his toolkit.
I think one of the saddest things I've seen, and I was, you know, I grew up in New York, so I actually, despite him being bad with the media, I actually loved Patrick Ewing as a player, mm-hmm. was Patrick Ewing, Georgetown legend, coaching in a 90% empty home arena and fans chanting for him to be fired. I thought that was one of the most heartbreaking yeah. scenes I've seen in sports.
And in all of college sports, I put a lot of that on the university. And you really have to, especially when you bring in a guy like that who's coming from the NBA, you have to ballast that coach, your most important alumni. So I put, of course, a lot of it on Patrick, but there is blame to be spread around.
I just want to say, I feel like I'm in good company right now, because in 2017, your high school newspaper had a piece headline, scoring an interview with Blair alumna Eva Wallace. So I feel like cool. I'm pretty psyched that I also, me and Olivia Gonzalez have both scored interviews with Blair alumna Eva Wallace. It is interesting because you are 30.
Come on, man.
You're almost 30.
Thank you.
And in a way, you're like the last generation of people who entered this business where the business probably felt a little hopeful still, where, oh, I could work for Sports Illustrated. Oh my God, ESPN, the magazine was probably still floating around when you entered the business. You had the Washington Post and New York Times, The Athletic kind of blooming around that time a little later, where you could be a writer. You weren't a tweeter. You weren't a, you know, you were a writer, and all these things were there. And when I read the interview with scoring an interview with Blair alumna Eva Wallace,
oh my God.
With Olivia Gonzalez, you sort of, coming out of high school, seemed like one who is very, very hopeful about journalism and really passionate about journalism. You went to Northwestern, you scored an internship at the Miami Herald at a very young age. I don't know if you're entering nowadays, you know, you're Eva Wallace and you're graduating from high school or college in 2023. Are you going to law school?
That's something I've been thinking about a lot, because it's summer internship season. And of course you have younger people, you know, who are like, what do I do? Where do I go? I was also at Wimbledon, you know, sitting a couple rows over from some New York Times writers when that news broke. I think the thing that was said a lot when I was coming out of school, and it was kind of just starting to be like, yeah, you can still do it, but it's not the best degree to have, yeah. was there are so many more things than there were 5 years ago. And now I don't know if that's true. And I especially don't know if that's true if you want to be a good classic, whatever that means, like newspaper journalist. I always wanted to work in newspapers. I don't really know why. I guess I'm kind of like stuffy and futsy. But if you had aspirations like I did to write for a newspaper and like kind of do the daily thing of writing every day and understanding the community around you, there aren't that many places anymore. And that is a huge bummer. And I don't know what to tell kids who say that they want to do what I do, other than hopefully if you adjust your expectations or adjust maybe the way you want to tell stories or the way you want to engage with the community, there's something out there for you. But you're catching me at kind of a really like bummer time for that. I don't have a good answer for that. And I don't know if I'm going to law school, but maybe I'm doing something else.
I think one thing that flipped a little bit is like when you came out of college, you had a pretty quick rise, you know, like
Yeah.
You went to USA Today quickly. Then you went to Washington Post. Like, that's a quick rise.
Yeah.
And I feel like young journalists started to expect that you could come out of college and get to these places quick. I can get to The Athletic quick. I can get to the Washington Post quick, which wasn't the case when I came out. I graduated college in 1994. You were going to work your way up.
But where do you go in between? That's the problem.
Sure. But I think if I was coming out of school right now and I want to be a journalist, I'm the same kid, University of Delaware. I'm graduating now, though. Mm-hmm. I'm applying to 300 newspapers all across the country, just like I did back then. Yeah. And I may have to start in Danville, Illinois, covering preps like you had to 30 years ago.
Which is what I did. I didn't get any of those jobs, though. I started USA Today as an internship where I did not apply to USA Today. I have to think it was someone at Northwestern who was like, hey, I got this person over here because I didn't apply to that job and got an internship that way. And that is where, like, I will thank my stars forever that I got into Northwestern, because that set me up. Like, the same thing with that internship at the Miami Herald. Like, we had to do those internships. Like, I applied for them. Yes, did the work. But, like, they had a relationship with the university. So it's that kind of stuff.
I do want to say, Ava Wallace byline, September 23rd, 2014, a sizzling article, Capital One, named new sponsor of Orange Bowl. Don't give me that look, Ava Wallace. I complimented your name. Here we go. Lead. Capital One. Capital One has secured the title sponsorship of the Orange Bowl as part of an agreement with ESPN. The Orange Bowl committee announced early Monday. Ava, how did you come up with that lead? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I mean, that's the other thing is when I got hired at the Post, yes, I'd worked at USA Today, but like, that was my first, like, I got there, I checked in with my editor. He was like, great, you should drive to Blacksburg. Frank Beamer's last game is on Saturday. You should write about that. And I was like, I was so bad at my job for so many years. And I am not, that is not me being modest. Like, people at the Post, like, helped me and like helped me learn how to do it. And the places that give you a chance, certainly places like the Washington Post that give you a chance to grow and like become good, are really few and far between nowadays.
Well, I was trying to find the story. Here we go. Ava Wallace.
No. Oh my God. Please. I will pay you money to not read this.
You already told me you're not a bazillionaire, so I'm not taking the money. Virginia Tech football gets ready for new era with familiar win over Virginia. No, let's go into this. Ava, seriously. When the two coaches met on the field before kickoff Saturday, they shook hands knowing it would be the last time at least one, if not both, would coach in their school's long-running football rivalry. First of all, why is this bad? This isn't bad. Let me keep reading. Virginia Tech coach Frank Beamer was a fortunate one Saturday at Scott Stadium. A 42-yard field goal by Joey Sly and a jump interception by Chuck Clark in the fourth quarter gave the Hokies a 23-20 victory over Virginia, earning the Commonwealth Cup for the 15th time in the past 16 years. Wait, I'm not saying it's like Pulitzer, but why is this bad? You didn't even know what you were doing.
I just remember panic. Oh my God. I just remember pure panic because there was so much going on. It was like, and now I'm thinking back, like that game was like being at a music festival. Like there was so much stuff about Frank Beamer and so many people to talk. Like, and I was like, the score of the game, here you go. When like, you know, like that's not how I would do it nowadays. So like, yes, it's not bad. But is it what the Washington Post maybe should have been publishing about Frank Beamer's last game in an area that hypothetically cares about Virginia Tech? It probably could have sent Feinstein, but you know.
Wait, this is why I love this doing this podcast. Okay, it's 2015. You're hired by the Washington Post. They send you to Charlottesville. I wouldn't have even known who Frank Beamer is. I'm assuming you're from the area. You knew who Frank Beamer was.
I mean, I knew who he was because I watched college football.
Like, I would have no idea. I hate college football. Right. All right, so.
Okay. Me too.
Like, it's Frank Beamer's last game. You're going to go cover it. And you're like, you had no fucking idea what to do, correct?
I had no idea what to do. I had a 4-hour drive to get my shit together. And then once I got there, I was just like, the story was apparent. Like everyone cared. So there were like signs being like, I met my wife at a Virginia. Like, thank you, Frank. Like, you know, all that stuff. Like that, while I felt like, oh my God, this is such a big assignment for the Washington Post. They were probably like, this is an easy one. A toddler could do it. Enjoy. Like no one else wants to drive 4 hours on a Saturday. You go for it.
Okay. So here's my question for you. 8 years later, almost 30, but not quite 30 yet. And a bazillionaire. Like they assigned the story to you now. They're like, hey, Ava, we know you don't cover this, but we kind of need a reporter to handle this. How do you approach it in a different way as a veteran journalist?
I just don't write about the game. Like, I'm sure I wrote so much about the game that day. Please don't look it up. Please stop Googling.
I'm not looking.
Okay. I'm sure because I was like, well, my job was to write about this game and game story. Like, I'm sure. And I would just not do that. And I would cover it as a scene piece, or like, honestly, probably the way we would do that now is like do a long sit down with Beamer 2 days beforehand and run it in the Sunday paper and whatever. Like that's how kind of we do things now. Or I would have found something about the game. Like I would have been looking out for players somehow through football him showing any sign of emotion, or I would zero in on a guy who just really wanted to win this one for Frank one last time. Give me all those stories where I can get into an emotional football team or a little bit of sentimentality.
I just want to say, because this is our first time meeting and you're doing my podcast and you seem like a very nice person, I'm not going to read the 7 paragraphs of play-by-play in this story. I will not do it.
Like 7 paragraphs about a college football game, like that people probably want. Like, what do we, you know, that's what I'm saying. Play-by-play is so horrible.
You covered the Washington Mystics. And I do want to say, as a University of Delaware grad, Elena Deladon is my favorite WNBA player. Definitely the greatest athlete to come out of Delaware, Joe Flacco, Rich Gannon, be damned. I feel like personally, I would rather cover the WNBA than the NBA. I think you're nodding your head, so I'm even going to stop my thinking there. Why am I right?
I always kind of had this idea when I guess I started out that like I really want to write about the things that go undercovered and, you know, like do these stories that people know and tells women's stories and da da da. While that is definitely still true, like I think people view the WNBA as like much more cool than they did even when I was covering it. But just because it was like untapped, it was like an untapped gold mine. Like there were so many characters, there were so many personalities. Again, I was really like not that much younger than a lot of these women. It also inspired me in a way. Like I don't get impressed easily to a fault. Like sometimes someone will be like, did you just see that? Are you going to write about that? And I'm like, oh, I guess I should consider that. But in the WNBA, I was like, oh my God, like these women are incredible. So yeah, I just found it much richer territory. And I don't love the gamesmanship of the NBA reporting landscape. And there was way less of that in the WNBA.
What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
There's so much schmoozing and relationship stuff you have to do. And like, oh, you got to drop names and conversation. And if you don't know, which I never know because I'm not very good at my job. Like, oh my God, you don't know this person? Or like, blah, 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 blah. I really don't care for that part of the NBA stuff. I don't find it benefits you anymore just because of the Woj and Shamsification of NBA reporting. So it's kind of like you have to do it. And I'm like, okay, well, why do I have to do it if it's not going to get me anywhere? And there's less of that in the WNBA. It definitely exists. It exists in every sport, of course, but there's certainly less of it.
If you could name every journalist in the country, the two I would not want to be, and this is no indictment of them personally, are Woj and
Steve. Oh, no. Same. Like,
zero interest.
I'd love to sleep, personally. Right. So,
Elena Deladon, I'm guessing, did not make you wait 3 hours to interview her.
She could be a little diva on you, which it takes on a different tone in the WNBA. You kind of want to be like, okay, you earned the right to do this. I mean, talk to me, but you know, yeah. No one in the WNBA is as much of a diva as anybody in the NBA for sure. And yeah, it's much more like weird when a player doesn't want to talk to you. And there are definitely players who are like, my agents are controlling, you know, who I talk to in my media career from that standpoint, blah, 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 blah. And that's frustrating because a lot of WNBA reporters will be like, oh my God, help me help you. Like, why are you getting in your own way here? But yeah, it's more often, yes, I would love to tell my story. And once you kind of convince players to give up the control, because a lot of them still see the media landscape nowadays and say, oh, I only want to tell you this, or I want you to come out and view me in this way and don't write that and da 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 da. If you can get a player who is willing to kind of seed that stuff, then you've struck gold. And there's a lot of stuff to write about in the WNBA. And I think it's not that hard, or as hard as people make it out to seem, to get people to care about those stories.
You wrote a piece in 2019, Why Am I Different? Behind this WNBA player's activism was a search for the answer. This is a great story about Natasha Cloud. No, do you disagree? This is a good one, right?
I related to it personally, so that makes me happy that you thought it was good.
I was going to ask you about this, but it's the lead is some 30 minutes after Washington Mystics lost to the Seattle Storm on June 14th in Southeast DC, starting point guard Natasha Cloud moved from her seat along the back wall of the Mystics locker room to stand at the front, pausing twice to maneuver around various reporters pointing TV cameras and cell phones at her face. She was not among the Mystics' leading scorers that night, but she would be their only player to address the media. Her voice quavering but strong, Cloud, 27, read a prepared statement on behalf of the team rather than answer questions about the game. She followed through on plans she announced the day before on Instagram to hold a, quote, media blackout to address only gun violence in Washington. Cloud's public action came together over a little more than 24 hours, but it was the culmination of a long journey, the result of maturation, her increased status with the Mystics since the start of last season, and most importantly, a level of comfort in her own skin that took years to achieve. And it's about, obviously, Natasha Cloud, guard for the Wizards, who never knew she was biracial, never knew that her father was Black. And literally says in the story, I'm just like, I'm different, and always assumed she was tan. And she finds out later in life, it's an amazing, amazing saga. And you told it really, really well. What do you remember about doing this piece?
I remember when Natasha first told me that she hadn't realized. And I feel like I'm also mixed. My dad is Black and my mom is white. And I feel like there's two answers where you're always kind of like, really? You didn't know nothing about that? Or it's like, yeah, I get it. And I know that that happens. I know there's a long history of that in this country. There's already so much identity crisis that a lot of biracial kids experience, but I cannot imagine not knowing why you're having that identity crisis and not being able to navigate, like, well, I don't fit in with this group and I don't all the way fit in with this group, but, like, you know, I'm finding my way. I can't imagine not at least having concrete answers or a concrete origin. And then I found it interesting just because, like, Tosh spoke about it so differently than anything else I'd ever talked to her about. Like, she was still very clearly figuring it out and working through some stuff. But it was just kind of one of those things that makes your ears perk up, where it's like, one, I related to it personally and I felt like I could ask her the right questions. And it's always so fascinating. Like, you know, whenever you feel different in any kind of way, you love talking to someone who feels different in the same way as you, just being like, oh, and this, and relating all that way. So there was that. But it was also, as a reporter, I was just like, you are acting differently now. Why is that? And that makes me interested. And that was definitely one of those stories. And she was really good and very open.
Do you feel like your background allows you to write that story in a way, if I come along and I'm like, oh, I found out blah, 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 that I could not?
I think yes, but I don't know if everyone can tell. Like, I'm sure you would write that story beautifully. And I've read a lot of stories about race, but I bet I would read that story written by you and been like, I wish you'd asked about that.
Yeah.
Or like, oh, I wish you'd gotten her to say that. Whereas everyone else would be like, wow, incredible story. What a great, you know, because a good story is a good story in the right hands. But yeah, there's a specificity that I really like trying to get at and trying to make people talk about. And I'm not always successful, but it's a nice feeling when you are.
I got to ask you a final question. It's a required question on this podcast.
Okay.
What is the maddest, as a journalist, someone has been at you?
That doesn't happen that much in the NBA, or at least in colleges, but not in a good way. I wish it happened more, where people were just like, why'd you do that? Stop it. And instead, they'll just like be petty and give you the cold shoulder, and you have to go up to them and be like, can we talk through what happened? Where it's just like, that's so stupid and annoying.
I hate those moments where you have to go up to an athlete and be like, hey, are we cool? Blah, blah, blah. And you're like, I know you don't give a shit about me. So I'm basically saying, are you... I don't even know what I'm saying, because it's Seth Bush. Yeah. This guy doesn't care about me. He doesn't even know how many kids I have. You know, like, they don't care.
The worst part is when it's not even athletes. Like, if you're an agent or a PR person, do your job. Just call me. The maddest someone has ever been with was actually Patrick Ewing, when at Georgetown, my second year, maybe, like, in the middle of, like, a random night in October, two kids got taken off the roster. And it's kind of, like, bubbling up on, like, message boards. And like, what are these two kids off? And you do a Google search, and they come up in court records, da-da-da-da. There were restraining orders filed against two. So then it becomes like, was this an assault thing? Was this a sexual violence thing? Something like that. And because there were restraining orders filed and there were court orders, there were cell phone numbers. And so I then have to call these two 18-year-old freshman kids, being like the whole time on the phone, being like, please don't pick up. Please don't pick up. Both of them picked up. Damn and it. So I was like, Ava Wallace, Washington, but like, you know, I had to act and be like, do the journalism thing. And Georgetown, as strict as they are with media, do not let freshmen speak until their second semester, which I think is a huge disservice to them and does not prepare them for the rest of the time, what they'll have to do, blah, 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 blah. Somehow in that policy, no one ever told them, don't pick up when a random phone call calls you. So that is probably the maddest, when I had to go up to Patrick Ewing the next day and say, And he was just like, he didn't say a single word to me for like 2 or 3 weeks, and would just glower at me. And like being glowered at by Patrick Ewing was like really quite something. And I had to go up and say like, and I, you know, got on my big girl pants and was like, Patrick, you know, I had to do that. I know, you know why I did that. That was me being fair. I hope you understand that. And he just kind of looked at me and was so mad, but like gave me a little nod. You know, he's an adult and he understands what happens probably better than most, but he was so mad at me. But it was nice that I think he understood, or at least I told myself he understood. But yeah, man, I can like conjure that image of him glaring at me right now in front of my eyes. He was a good glarer.
Those phone calls are the worst. In my career, I have dialed numbers and hung up where I'd be like, yep, I can't do this. I'm not ready to do this yet. I hate those calls.
I knew in my mind, if someone picked up, they were not prepared. No one had told them how it was going to go. Like,
right.
So I felt icky about it, but you know, listen, you shouldn't have done what you done.
Did the kids talk to you?
They gave like very unhelpful, like, what, who is this? No comment. I didn't do that. Like, you know, as soon as they like started going, I'd be like, I'm just asking you this, like, da, 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 da. Do you have anything you want to say? This is what I'm putting in the newspaper. But they were just mad that like I called them.
I get it.
Which is my job.
Let me ask you a final question. This is an important one.
Okay.
What would you say was a bigger moment from the Virginia Tech game? Was it when quarterback Matt Johns threw a 27-yard touchdown pass, or was it when Virginia Tech answered with a 32-yard pass from to a wide open Isaiah Ford? I need to know.
Oh my God.
I changed that because neither was that big, because the Hokies forced Virginia to punt and then they embarked on a 10-play 56-yard.
You know, there are people who are good at writing college football, like play by play and like make it come alive. And I was just like, 32-yard pass to a 24-yard punt. Like,
well, you work with Chuck Culpepper, who might be the best.
Oh, Chuck Culpepper could like take those same two sentences and make them like dance a tango together somehow. Like, it's very cool writing at a place where everyone is so good.
Someone said to me recently that there's no destination anymore. Like, one thing that has changed is like Sports Illustrated used to be the destination. ESPN used to be the destination. Bleacher Report magazine for a while, a destination. And I feel like the Washington Post right now, sports wise, is probably the destination.
Everyone is so mind-bendingly good at what they do, and they're so generous with their time and knowledge. And that is like, I've never, like, whenever other places have been like, oh, would you consider, I'm like, if you hired this person, this person, this person, and this person, yes, then I would, like, you know, like, it's an incredible group of people, and I'm really, 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 really privileged to get to work with them and write that scintillating play-by-play.
Well, Ava, number one, thank you for doing this. Number two, I'm being sincere when I say this. I think you fit in right in there. I think you're excellent. I think you're great. And like, I also think like the growth from like, I know you hate that story and it was a totally fine game story, but like, we all like grow and like, you're a fucking great writer and you just bring it. And I am very appreciative that you took time out of your maybe not busy day to do this. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I hope the next person you talk to can give me more hope about the state of our industry, because I'm actively looking for it. And I feel like I was a bummer, but I want to feel hopeful.
I want to thank today's guest, Ava Wallace, for joining me on Two Riders Slinging Yang. You can follow Ava on Twitter at Ava R. Wallace and read her work in the Washington Post. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, be safe, everybody.
Keep writing.